there is as yet no terminal date. This is the epidemic which rages around as we speak. And in that way, looking at HIV/AIDS is different from the other four that I've looked at this week. It's still underway. It is quietly claiming about 300 lives in South Africa every day. And if you think about that, that probably means that in the course of this lecture of an hour, about a dozen or 15 people will die in South Africa of AIDS-related diseases. So that means that getting a historical perspective on HIV/AIDS is much more difficult than on the other epidemics about which I've spoken this week. It's difficult to know how it will terminate, when it will terminate, indeed, if it will terminate. And so that kind of closure, which is possible with regard to the other epidemics that I've looked at this week, that's not possible with regard to HIV/AIDS. In another way, HIV/AIDS is also different to the other epidemics about which I've spoken this week. It is, as that subtitle suggests, it's a slow-moving epidemic. It takes at least 6 years from infection, from the actual infection with the HIV virus, for them to manifest themselves in a person's health, usually in the form of diminished resistance to other diseases. And even then, it takes another 1 or 2 years beyond those 6 years for it to become terminal as AIDS. And so it's very different in character from smallpox and Spanish flu and plague, not only because of its gradual evolution and the opportunities it offers to intervene during the course of the epidemic. I mean, there was, as you will have gathered during the other epidemics, swift onset, fulminating, engulfing, overwhelming, barely a moment to take breath. With regard to HIV/AIDS, it's much more slow-moving, and that means that interventions, indeed perhaps even the development of countermeasures and counter-medical treatment are possible. And in that regard, it's quite different from those other epidemics. It also means its slow-moving character, about 6 years to manifest itself from infection, and then another 1 or 2 years to become terminal. It also means that people who are unable to access any kind of treatment to delay it or to slow it down are a long time dying. Again, very different to those other epidemics, which were quick, sharp onset, and if you remember, with regard to Spanish flu, die Driedagsekte, the three-day plague. HIV/AIDS is very different to that. And the fact that it takes several years for people who are untreated to die produces another whole constellation of features and circumstances which mark it out as distinctive and distinctively different from those other epidemics. So, though it doesn't possess those whirlwind-like features of the other epidemics, cumulatively, its effect has been no less lethal and no less widespread. It has claimed, either directly or indirectly, over 3.5 million lives in South Africa in the 31 years since it was first diagnosed here in 1982. It's telling of its impact to look at some labels, some colloquial and popular labels for HIV/AIDS. It may not be Driedagsekte, but in Xhosa it's referred to often as the chopper or stepping on a live wire. I translate from the Xhosa for you. So its impact in terms of fear it generates, in terms of panic it causes, in terms of dread, is no less so than in the case of the other epidemics that I've talked about. As in the previous four lectures, if we're going to understand something about the nature of this epidemic, we need to know something about the pathogen, about the HI virus and its course. So let me start by talking about the nature of the pathogen and its course through a human system. The fact that the HI virus, the human immunodeficiency virus, infection occurs with the HI virus primarily during heterosexual or homosexual intercourse, when an infected person's semen or vaginal secretions which contain the virus is transferred to an uninfected person's system. The fact that this is the primary mode of transmission through sexual intercourse goes a long way to explain the disease's high prevalence in South Africa's population, especially amongst the sexually active teenagers and young adults. In addition to this component of the population, sexually active teenagers and young adults, there are, I think, three other groups which have been at particular risk of infection with the HI virus. Babies born to HIV-positive mothers who might be infected in the womb or during delivery or through taking breast milk. Secondly, hemophiliacs and transfusion recipients who unwittingly receive the HI virus from HIV-infected blood. And thirdly, health workers who accidentally come into contact with an infected person's blood, most commonly through what is referred to as a needle stick injury. So in addition to the primary group, sexually active teenagers, young adults, these three others are ones where particular attention one should pay because of their high risk of infection. Once in a newly infected person's bloodstream, the HI virus gradually erodes that person's ability to resist other pathogens by destroying the CD4 cells, which are at the core of the body's immune system. When an infected person's CD4 counts drops from the usual 1,200 or so cells per microliter of blood to about 200 cells per microliter of blood, when the drop reaches about 200, his or her immune system is so compromised as to be unable to withstand even quite mild opportunistic secondary infection. It's at this point, when the CD4 count drops to 200 or lower, that HIV turns into full-blown AIDS, usually, as I suggested, something of the order of about 6 years after the original infection. And once it turns into full-blown AIDS, there is no recovery unless antiretroviral drugs are implemented or provided almost immediately, because they check the proliferation of the HI virus. If antiretroviral drugs are not provided, death follows, as I indicated, within 1 or 2 years, usually from an opportunistic infection which the body's now very compromised immune system is unable to withstand. Most commonly, the opportunistic infections might be TB, that's by far the most common, less so pneumonia, influenza, meningitis. And so we need to recognize this almost fatal combination between HIV and TB. The one is very much working together with the other. They are synergistic. HIV boosts the incidence of TB so that together they constitute two intertwined epidemics that complement each other. At present, as you will know, there is no medical cure, no medical preventive for HIV/AIDS. So that's a little bit of introductory background to the nature of the pathogen, of the HIV virus, and its mode of transmission, and then what it does to the body's immune system. From that, I now must begin to sketch the epidemic and its course in South Africa. It seems that the HIV virus arrived in South Africa along two quite distinct pathways.
Excuse me, could you go back just one step to how it started?
I would rather deal with that, because that's a long a question in questions at the end. I want to sketch the South African context to when I will refer to that as well. There are, in South Africa, two subtypes, or, as it is known, clades of the HIV virus. The first clade, it's called clade B, reached South Africa in the late 1970s. And it reached South Africa probably from the United States, where it had begun to manifest itself in the late 1970s among gay men. This clade B was introduced into South Africa in the late 1970s, probably from the United States, by one or more gay men. The first two diagnosed cases in South Africa fits exactly into this pattern. The first two diagnosed cases in South Africa in 1982 were two SAA air stewards who died in Pretoria in 1982 of a pneumonia that their immune systems ought to have been able to resist. But because their immune systems had been so eroded, so compromised by the HIV virus, they were unable to do so. Their immune systems were deficient, and consequently, they were unable to fight off these cases of pneumonia. And these are the first two recorded cases in South Africa in 1982. If, as I indicated, it takes a number of years for the disease to reach that level of AIDS, we can go back to assume that the original infection had taken place a couple of years before 1982, which is why I say they were probably infected in the late 1970s. Within a year, 32 more gay men in Johannesburg were diagnosed as being HIV positive. So that's the path, the likely path, of clade B into South Africa from the United States. The other clade is, the other subtype is clade C, subtype C. And subtype C appears to have been brought to South Africa a little later than clade B, and it appears to have come not from the United States, but from the very heartland of the disease in Central and East Africa, which is where the first cases really we can track down as beginning to manifest themselves already in the 1970s. The first recorded cases of clade B in South Africa were diagnosed amongst migrant Malawian workers, mine workers working on the Witwatersrand in 1986. By then, HIV was very well established in their homelands, in Malawi, in Uganda, in what was then Zaire, firmly established in their homelands, and it was positively rampant in East African countries, particularly Uganda and Zaire. So the first two cases of clade C, diagnosed amongst Malawian mine workers working on the Witwatersrand in 1986. Within 2 months of that diagnosis in 1986, two local women who had consorted with the Malawians on the Witwatersrand were diagnosed as HIV positive as well. So these are the two likely routes by which HIV reached South Africa. The one across from the United States, the second from Central and East Africa. If we take those as the very beginnings of HIV presence in South Africa, by no means yet an epidemic, it's possible then to periodize how those individual outbreaks turned into an epidemic. And the way I'm going to do that is by characterizing three phases, three periods in that growth from initial arrival to full-scale epidemic. And being a born and bred Cape Townian, I'm going to use an analogy which any Cape Townian will know very well from winter storms. I'm going to use a three-part meteorological comparison. So the first phase, the phase from 1982 to 1986, I would compare to a pre-cold front trough, which precedes a gathering storm. So, a handful of cases, and a hope that what followed would pass quickly without causing major damage. So just a sense that there is something which is coming, but really nothing extensive, nothing really to set the alarm bells ringing wildly, what I call a prefrontal trough. Sticking with this meteorological metaphor, the second phase from 1986 to 1985, those of you who know the course of a cold front coming into Cape Town will know that after that first prefrontal trough, there follows a lowering sky ahead of the storm, in which the HIV began to spread beyond those pockets of gay men and minors and unobtrusively infect the population at large. In 1991, the number of HIV-positive heterosexuals exceeded the number of HIV-positive homosexuals for the first time. And by 1992, at least 2.2% of pregnant women attending public health sector facilities were HIV positive. So in 1992, just over 2% of women, pregnant women attending public health facilities were identified as HIV positive. But given what I have sketched already about the nature of the disease, it takes a long time to move from HIV infection to AIDS and death. The number of AIDS deaths in this second phase, this lowering sky phase, still trailed far behind because of this time lag between infection and the escalation into AIDS. But what is clear is that during this second phase, from 1986 to 1985, as the sky became more and more overcast, this lowering sky, out of the public eye, which exactly at this point, between 1986 and 1995, public eye so focused on the dramatic political transition in South Africa, out of the way of public gaze, where so many people were focused on this dramatic political turnabout, South Africa's clearly was the seeds for a generalized epidemic were being rapidly and abundantly sown. And so we come to the third phase. Once the numbers of AIDS-related deaths began to top 5,000 per year in 1995, that, I think, marks another watershed, the end of the lowering sky and the beginning of the third phase in which we are still present. From 1995 to the present, the deluge. By 1995, that 2.2% of pregnant women had risen to 10.4% of pregnant women identified as HIV positive. And then it's from that 1995 stage that this threatening storm broke open and an escalating surge of cases and indeed of deaths began to manifest themselves. In a variety of quite grotesque and grim ways. One of those markers is that repeatedly one hears that from the mid-1990s, more and more hearses began to be visible in the rural areas of KwaZulu-Natal over weekends, as funerals began to mount up in number and in number. That's just one of the markers of the onset of this third phase, the deluge. By 2010, the 10.4% of women who had been HIV positive, identified as HIV positive, had risen to 30.2% of pregnant women. By 2010, AIDS deaths stood at just under 190,000 per year, having been at 5,000 per year in 1995. These are the grim features of HIV/AIDS in this most devastating phase of all, what I've labelled the deluge. These are the figures which have made South Africa the centre of the world's HIV pandemic. In 2011, South Africa contained more HIV-positive people, that's about 10.5% of South Africa's population, 5.3 million, more HIV-positive people than any other country in the world. And particularly in the worst-hit areas of South Africa, KwaZulu-Natal, Mpumalanga, Free State, and the Northwest, the figures are even higher. More than a third of pregnant women attending public health care facilities there are HIV positive. I've used words, but often the most effective way to follow this growing deluge is graphics. The top three maps show from light, where there's no data, HIV prevalence percentage going darker and darker and darker. 1995, 2000, you can see those most affected provinces, and 2005. And then you can see, I mentioned that HIV and TB are intertwined. The bottom three are number of TB cases, 1995, 2000, 2005. You can see that close intertwining of the two. So you have some idea now of the development of the epidemic, why an outbreak became an epidemic. Now we need to look at, how an outbreak became an epidemic. Now we need to look at why. What are the reasons for an outbreak turning into a large-scale runaway epidemic? The short answer to this fundamental, basic question is that, like all diseases that become epidemics, and indeed I hope you will have recognized this during the week, HIV/AIDS has rooted itself in South Africa by taking full advantage of existing social, economic, cultural, and political conditions in the society. In the telling words of one historian, it was an epidemic waiting to happen in perfect storm conditions. And if we look at those underlying conditions, you will recognize that some of them were deeply rooted in the nature of the South African society and the South African economy going back a very long way, as that historian has used that term, an epidemic waiting to happen. The first is the existence of the century-old migrant labor system, which removed young African men from their rural families and concentrated them for months at a time in single-sex compounds and hostels in faraway cities, which set of conditions created very congenial circumstances for multiple concurrent sexual relationships, and thereby a high risk of contracting HIV, which was then taken back to their rural homes when they returned at the end of their contract period. The circumstances in rural areas only facilitated this spread, this rooting of HIV into the rural population. The high incidence of sexually transmitted diseases in the population facilitated the infection by HIV virus. and also the low status of young women in patriarchal African communities made them particularly vulnerable to being infected with HIV. A second rooted condition within the South African society and economy, which facilitated the transformation of an outbreak into an epidemic, was the presence, particularly from 1989, when the road haulage system was deregulated, of a growing number of truckers, long-distance truck drivers, who were known even before, long before HIV appeared, who were known to frequent sex stopovers as they travelled the country's roads. After 1989, when the road freight system was deregulated, the number of such drivers on the road increased enormously, crisscrossing the country, often stopping for sex at a number of spots throughout the country. Commercial sex of this sort offered many an opportunity for the HIV virus to infect these men, and for them in turn to infect other sex workers or indeed their families. A third element in these underlying conditions which helped to explain why an outbreak turned into an epidemic. We go to the other end of the age spectrum. Not truck drivers in their 20s, 30s, 40s, but the Soweto generation, the generation of Africans who led the revolt against apartheid from 1976 through to 1994. That challenge to the political system also produced a challenge to the traditional constraints on sexual activity in many families, as the Soweto generation rejected or ignored the conservative sexual mores of their elders in the heat of the struggle. In this environment of a rejection of a whole array of constraints on sexual activity, the reluctance of parents, many African parents, to talk about sexual matters to their children only enhanced a willingness and a readiness and a daringness to experiment. During the 1980s, calculated that the age of sexual debut, the average age of sexual debut amongst young African teenagers dropped to as low as 16 years. Fourthly, in trying to understand the underlying conditions which facilitated the outbreak turning into an epidemic, even after the end of apartheid, after 1994, the new democratic government in South Africa did not set about rebuilding the family structures which had been so shattered and fragmented by decades of apartheid legislation and measures. Nor did it do very much to curb the surging emphasis in advertising and in the media on sex. Or indeed did it do very much to halt the migrant labour system. You only have to think of what Marikana has revealed about the continuing operation of the migrant labour system to know that that is something deeply rooted even till today. A survey in 2000 found that one third of African boys believe that, quote, having many sexual partners means I am cool or hip. Fifthly, in trying to identify the underpinning conditions, is that it's likely that the end of apartheid probably added to the pool of HIV-positive people in South Africa through the return of political exiles, people who had gone into exile, particularly after 1976, after Soweto, and had particularly gone into exile in countries where, just at that point, HIV was raging. Uganda, Tanzania, north of the Limpopo. It is likely, though it's very difficult to document, but it would be strange if at least some of those people did not contract HIV/AIDS in these years, in these heartlands of HIV, the early HIV epidemic. And when they returned then to South Africa, they returned as HIV-positive individuals. Sixthly, in trying to understand why the outbreak became epidemic, amongst African males of all ages and nationalities, the risk of HIV infection was heightened by an abiding reluctance of many to use condoms, either because before 1994, some saw condoms as a deliberate apartheid-inspired ploy to curb the African population growth, or because of a dominant culture of machismo, of maleness, required flesh-to-flesh sexual intercourse. In the words of one person interviewed, using a condom is like wasting one's sperm, and this in a context where fathering many children was perceived as, quote, a positive sign of virile masculinity. You pull together these underlying conditions, some of very long standing, others perhaps of more recent standing, and you've got what one commentator has called an AIDS superhighway, a set of circumstances which taken together really push very far to help us understand why an outbreak became such a devastating epidemic. The apartheid government, until 1994, any steps which it sought to take to try and intervene were almost ipso facto, by the very fact that they came from the apartheid government, rejected and denied by particularly the Soweto generation of Africans. Everything which emanated from the apartheid government was seen with great hostility, circumspection, and doubt and suspicion. And so any messages, any attempts at countermeasures in the 1980s were, coming from government circles, were the subject of great scorn, rejection, and a refusal. Indeed, there is some anecdotal evidence that in some circles in African townships on the Witwatersrand, the label AIDS, which began to be used, was explained as Afrikaner invention to deprive us of sex. After 1994, the post-1994 government, the ANC government, was not much more successful in altering sexual behaviour for its first dozen years or so. A lack of direction, a lack of capacity, a focus on trying to create a wholly new political structure, a lack of will, a lack of coordination, and particularly during Thabo Mbeki's presidency, and indeed even his deputy presidency under Nelson Mandela, a lack of will, a lack of commitment. Tellingly, in these years after 1994, a large portion of the national AIDS budget was unspent. As one scholar observed very perceptively of the situation after 1994, and indeed before 1994, vulnerability to HIV is deeply entrenched in our social fabric, an epidemic waiting to happen. So having sketched the course of the epidemic, having suggested some of the underlying reasons, I now want to look at responses to the epidemic. And I will begin by looking at official responses. The official responses to the epidemic of the post-1994 national government, as I indicated before, the response of the apartheid government were almost impossible to, were rejected, and so really had very little purchase in the 1980s because of where they were coming from. Post-1994, the responses of the new government in South Africa were largely ad hoc and narrow in nature. They were embodied in six strategic or action plans tabled between 1994 and 2011. Since 1994, there have been six of these major plans which have sought to plot a counter campaign against HIV/AIDS. These six cleanse, emphasized four main areas for action. And I'll deal with each one of these. The first was prevention. The second was treatment and care. The third was research. And the fourth, human rights. So let me start by looking at official countermeasures focused on prevention. The attempts, as I've already suggested, to alter sexual behavior by exhortation or education or publicity met with very little success, despite the millions and millions spent on this attempt to prevent through educating people, through exhorting people, through publicizing campaigns. Public awareness campaigns were tried. The gospel of ABC, abstain, be faithful, and condomize. Here you can see it spelt out above on a poster in KwaZulu-Natal. That gospel of ABC, taken from the Ugandan experience, really had very little effect. The mass distribution of condoms, emphasis on the use of condoms, here's one of those many, many publicity campaigns to try and encourage, exhort people to utilize condoms. The staging of a specially commissioned AIDS-themed musical, you may just remember, Sarafina 2, 14.3 million rand. The introduction of life skills as a compulsory school subject, which specifically included sex education, all of these attempts had very limited impact on actual practice, had very little effect on altering sexual behavior. Indeed, one of the reasons is that just talking about such matters in what is still a generally socially conservative society like South Africa, just talking about such issues was often very unwelcome. For example, a clinic sister in Mpumalanga was dismayed to find that when she taught about HIV in local schools, quote, a lot of parents came to us and they complained that we are discussing sexual issues with their children, and they say they don't want their children to discuss sexual issues with anybody. Equally delicate was the official adoption in KwaZulu-Natal, particularly, of male circumcision as a means to prevent the transmission of HIV/AIDS. Because amongst Zulu speakers, circumcision had effectively been halted back in 1810s by King Shaka. So there was nearly 200 years of circumcision as being something not to be undertaken amongst Zulu speakers. So to overturn this required a very considerable and delicate series of cultural interventions. And it wasn't until 2009 that the state was confident enough of the preventive value of male circumcision to make it formally part of its HIV prevention program. And only then, when they managed to persuade the current Zulu king, King Goodwill Zwelithini, to give his backing to this. And you can see here is King Goodwill together with the KZN Minister of Health beginning to introduce male circumcision. This is at Nongoma in April 2010, helping the minister, a doctor, to, or at least posing as part of the, as someone introducing or implementing male circumcision. The greatest official contribution to HIV prevention in these years was the eventual provision of antiretroviral drugs at state clinics and at hospitals to prevent mother-to-child transmission. It took nearly 5 years to convince, to persuade, to force the state to make antiretrovirals available to pregnant mothers who were HIV positive. It took 2 court cases. It took sustained pressure from AIDS activists and doctors to force the less than willing Department of Health to agree to do so in 2002. By 2006, the ARV drug nevirapine was being offered to pregnant HIV positive women at numerous sites around the country. So this has been a very significant intervention, but slow in coming, forcing the government step by step, reluctantly, to concede this. Since 2006, it's been readily available at many sites around the country. The misgivings that the government's expressed, the cost, really have been completely overshadowed by the success of rolling out antiretroviral treatment to prevent mother-to-child transmission. An indication of the success is that from there being about 30% of all children born to HIV-positive mothers also being HIV-positive in 2001, in 2010, that had been reduced to 3.6%. So much for official attempts at prevention, official attempts at treatment and care. If the foot-dragging and attempts to retard the provision of ARVs to pregnant women who are HIV positive is one thing, that's nothing compared to the foot-dragging and excuses post-1994 to make antiretrovirals available to HIV positive people across the board. Great reluctance on the part of central government, indeed for a long time actively hostile, again for a combination of reasons, to provide antiretrovirals not just to pregnant women who are HIV positive, but to anyone who is HIV positive whose CD4 count had dropped. Financial reasons were put forward, infrastructural reasons were put forward, technical reasons were put forward, and indeed, particularly in the case of President Thabo Mbeki, and indeed even when he was vice president, ideological reasons, particularly his denialist beliefs about the very nature and source of the HIV virus. Thanks to Jonathan Shapiro, there is a brace of very pointed telling cartoons which allows us tragically to track the tragedy of denialism. This is one of the many in which Thabo Mbeki is denying and he's fiddling everything to try and keep at bay antiretrovirals. Antiretroviral drugs which effectively transformed HIV from a death sentence to a chronic condition that can be managed by systematic and regular treatment became affordable in the public sector in South Africa as long ago as 2001, thanks to grants from international bodies like the World Health Organization, the Global Fund Against HIV/AIDS, and effectively it was possible already in 2001, that's just in the second year of Thabo Mbeki's presidency, for ARVs to have been rolled out. Not until 2003, when the cabinet actually overrode Thabo Mbeki's hostility and reluctance, did a gradual rollout of ARVs become sanctioned. And even then, after the cabinet had overridden Thabo Mbeki's great reluctance, Thabo Mbeki's then Minister of Health, Manto Tshabalala Nsimang, a very obdurate figure indeed, and probably with his encouragement, took her time to implement the rollout nationally. And again, a very, very pointed Jonathan Shapiro cartoon. Exasperated AIDS activist laid a charge of culpable homicide against her and a fellow minister who were responsible, they insisted, for the death of 600 people per day who could have lived if they had been given ARVs. Mbeki and particularly Tshabalala Msimang were far keener, I'm still talking about treatment, were far keener on rolling out to HIV-positive people food supplements. You will remember a certain flirtation with the Dr. Matthias Rath with his enhanced vitamins. They were keener on providing food supplements to HIV-positive people rather than antiretroviral drugs, aimed at keeping up their health, or they sought perhaps to encourage home-based and community care to ease the pressure on hospitals and their staff. In her, what seems to me to be misconceived nationalist hostility to international pharmaceutical companies, Chabalala Mtsimang took her zeal even further by throwing her weight behind traditional African remedies. If you look very carefully, you'll see in her hand a box of beetroot, garlic, lemons, and African potatoes to replace antiretrovirals as treatment. Accordingly, state funds went into providing these vegetables as well as the more usual supplements, along with grants to those who provided home-based care. More orthodox was the third component of the care program, the energetic treatment of HIV-facilitating sexually transmitted infections and opportunistic infections. In treating STIs, sexually transmitted infections, and opportunistic infections like TB, South Africa had already a very well-established network of centers and units and clinics to provide treatment for these. And so the treatment provided there was extended and provided against opportunistic infections and against sexually transmitted infections. They set up voluntary counseling and testing sites and attached to these HIV testing sites as well. Gradually, these have been extended across the whole of the country, across all nine provinces. Third element in the official response research. In its nationalist wish to find an African remedy to an African disease, the post-1994 South African governments, and again particularly Thabo Mbeki, even when he was deputy president, it meant that they were inclined to rush in at the merest glint of some local magic bullet. In 1997, it did just this, giving two Pretoria researchers the red carpet treatment for their supposed AIDS cure, Virodine, and pressuring the Medicine Controls Council to approve Virodine for human trials, even long before it had gone through the regular processes of being tested. When the Medicine Controls Council refused to give Virodine the okay for human trials, the Medicine Controls Council's leadership was purged by the minister, but even a newly appointed Medicine Controls Council were equally unconvinced by the claims made for Virodine. The main ingredient, it was subsequently discovered, the main ingredient of Virodine was a very highly toxic industrial solvent, and it was dismissed as of no proven benefit for the treatment of HIV/AIDS. But that's an example of research very much focused on finding some African remedy for the African disease, an expression, it seems to me, very much of nationalist zeal. Smarting at this rebuff, the government turned instead to more orthodox scientific means to combat HIV/AIDS, and in 1999, it set up the South African AIDS Vaccine Initiative, SAVI, under the eyes of the Medical Research Council. The chief task of this program was to promote and coordinate to develop a vaccine to cure HIV/AIDS, and that's what it is still doing at the moment. And then finally, in terms of the official responses, the official response relating to human rights. In the same way as the Virodine affair made clear the ANC's political ethos, the stance of the post-1994 ANC government on human rights of HIV-positives was very strong indeed. Given the history of apartheid South Africa, in which human rights had been so actively overridden, the new government was determined to safeguard the rights of all HIV people, HIV-positive people. Opposed in principle, for obvious reasons, to discrimination and segregation, it outlawed government discrimination against employers who sought to exclude HIV-positive employees. It compelled medical aid schemes to remove any restriction on their membership of people who are HIV-positive. Government departments were not permitted to require HIV tests of applicants for jobs. And in prisons, prisoners were able to refuse to be tested for HIV positive, for HIV. Even in the South African National Defence Force, it was forced very reluctantly to accept that HIV status of any of its members should not be a cause to exclude them from normal deployment and military duties, provided their health was up to that. So if we look at this brace of responses across these four terrains, they are marked by a whole array of contradictions. Contradictions which are perhaps the hallmark of state policy towards HIV post-1994. A mixture of noble words and dilatory deeds. A mixture of state-of-the-art advice and wrong-headed decision-making. A mixture of all-inclusive schemes and perfunctory, poorly coordinated participation. The upshot of these contradictions, lamented Judge Edwin Cameron, very prominent AIDS activist in 2000, was, quote, grievous ineptitude, which, despite a raft of acronym-generating official task groups, workshops, committees, councils, strategic plans, action plans, proposals, signified, in his words, piteously little. Again, brilliantly summed up with the pen of Jonathan Shapiro. I turn now to unofficial responses to HIV/AIDS. For the most part, the private sector was even more behindhand in its reaction to the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Initially, the private sector generally averted its eyes from the looming problem of treating HIV-positive employees, treating them almost as if they were lepers. Only in the first decade of the 21st century did the private sector begin to accept that HIV was literally business's business. Even as late as 2004, three-quarters of companies surveyed lacked more than just an ad hoc policy on HIV/AIDS. The one industry which was much quicker to respond was the mining industry. The mining industry could not afford to be so tardy in its responses. By 1992, nearly 10% of those mine employees attending sexually transmitted infection clinics, 10% were diagnosed as HIV positive. By 2001, that 10% had risen to 30% of all its employees. In the words of a leading social economist, there seems little doubt that the huge single-sex hostels of the gold mining industry have become epicenters of the HIV/AIDS earthquake. Negotiations with the National Union of Mine Workers ensured that HIV-positive miners would not be victimized or unilaterally fired, but the escalating magnitude of the epidemic, particularly amongst miners, required preventive steps as well. Early measures to prevent HIV infection on the mines focused on awareness campaigns. Here's a peer educator speaking to a number of miners on an Anglo-American mine, trying to educate them to change their patterns of sexual behavior. HIV testing, the treatment of opportunistic infections, but all of these really were unable to make a significant impact on the escalating rate of HIV infection. By 2001, some companies were realizing that no mine is an island, and they began to extend their initiatives to surrounding communities where female sex workers were persuaded to become advocates of condom use and pushing HIV education. Some mines even offered periodic treatment for sexually transmitted infections to these sex workers free of charge. Not surprisingly, therefore, when antiretrovirals became affordable in 2003, a few big mining companies like Anglo American readily made these available to their employees whose CD4 count had dropped below 250. As a result of the rollout of antiretrovirals, HIV-positive miners were able to work a full day, absenteeism fell, the use of in-house healthcare services declined, and so did staff turnover. In 2011, savings were calculated in the gold mining industry, in Anglo-American mines, at being $93 per month, thanks to the rollout of antiretrovirals. Recognizing these material benefits, other mining houses followed suit. By 2006, half of the industry was providing antiretrovirals to their employees. In the very sober and hard-headed words of Anglo-American's chief medical officer, "We've done the health economics and shown that for every dollar we invest in our AIDS initiatives, we get a financial return that is way in excess of that initial investment." Another reason, it's not just altruism on the part, it's not just looking at their bottom line. Mine companies were also put under increasing pressure by the growing power and voice of the trade union movement, particularly the National Union of Mine Workers, that committed itself very strongly to preventing HIV/AIDS. So there's another pressure on the mining companies which propelled them in that direction. In the wider sector, pressure also put on business by a range, business and government, by a range of blossoming NGOs, best known of which was the Treatment Action Campaign, which came into being in 1992. The Treatment Action Campaign was committed to ensuring treatment for those infected by HIV positive, by the HIV virus, and many of them were workers. So it worked closely in hand with the trade union movement. The TAC, the Treatment Action Campaign, initially was aimed at protesting against the Department of Health's decision not to roll out the provision of early antiretroviral treatment, but it was soon going well beyond this to challenge pharmaceutical companies about the high price of antiretroviral drugs and on their opposition to the importation of generic substitutes. In 2001, the TAC's target shifted once again, particularly this time to government, particularly targeting the government for its foot dragging on making antiretrovirals available nationally, employing strategies which are very reminiscent of the anti-apartheid movement. Many of these sought court cases, marches, petitions, media campaigns, advocacy, and civil disobedience. TAC leaders like Zaki Ahmad on the left lambasted state policy, hounding and harrying responsible ministers and officials alike. The TAC also sought to vanquish those whose tacit support of Mbeki's stance meant that they were offering their own nostrums, their own attempts to so-called cure HIV, people like Dr. Matthias Rath. The TAC again embarked on media campaigns, lobbying, court cases, targeting these quacks, these opportunists. As a grassroots, single-issue, rights-based, politically savvy NGO, the TAC exemplified the new social movements of the post-Cold War era, of the post-apartheid era. You only have to compare the TAC's mode of putting pressure, of tackling an issue, with that of the organization and NGO which I talked about yesterday with regard to polio, the Polio Research Foundation, with its genteel beauty contests, horse contests to raise funds, horse rides, recitals, etc. It's a very different organization in a very different South Africa. In effect, that polio campaign sought social support, the TAC sought social challenge. In terms of the communal response to HIV, the weight, of course, has fallen on those people who have been HIV positive, diagnosed as HIV positive in the last 31 years. About 9 million such people. The weight on them and on their family and friends around them. One could think almost perhaps of three paths along which every one of them would have had to go. Some were driven by their own courage or family pressure along a route that we might call testing and treatment. Others, less courageous or perhaps with less family pressure, followed a route, a far gloomier route, of symptoms, silence, and cemetery. And perhaps a variant on that, disease, denial, death, poignantly captured in this photograph of an HIV-positive young man being wheelbarrowed to a clinic because he quite simply is unable to walk. Not only for him, but for his support, for his family. The weight of the HIV epidemic has been heavy and burdensome. This is one of the consequences of HIV being an epidemic in which dying takes a long time. The religious responses have been, as we have already picked up in the case of other epidemics, finger-pointing, any number of finger-pointing against sexual behavior, which was regarded as immoral. Initially, the fingers were pointed at gay men. Then, when it was clear that it wasn't only gay men, but promiscuity, fingers were pointed at young people who were identified as particularly promiscuous in their behavior. One young HIV-positive woman recounted how when she went to visit a doctor, a rather religious doctor she discovered, and she told him of her status, he said to me, "I'm going to die a terrible death. I have sinned. I have to pray to God for forgiveness because I was sleeping around." I was very angry with him because I did not expect that from a doctor. Nor was that religious judgment, that moral judgment on HIV-positive individuals limited just to anyone. Nelson Mandela's son, Makhato, was not spared such moral judgment either. When Makhato Mandela died in 2004, his father was constrained to request the public not to regard the disease as, quote, an extraordinary thing for which people go to hell and not to heaven. Stigma, very closely associated with the recognition or diagnosis of HIV in the individual. And not just words, but also, if you remember, the horrific case of Gugu Dlamini, a 26-year-old HIV-positive woman who was beaten to death by locals in KwaMashu in Durban in 1998 because, quote, she had shamed her community by disclosing her HIV status on TV and on radio programs. The burdens of HIV, not just on the individual, but on their circle, have been immense. The effect, the weight on affected families have been enormous. Although deprived of a sick person's income and their labor, these families' financial, social, and emotional resources to cope with providing care at home, to transport someone who's HIV positive to a clinic, in the words of one historian, the result is home neglect or managed death. Perhaps most poignantly summed up in the comment by Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi, who lost two of his eight children to AIDS. HIV has placed me on my knees and destroyed my family. Since the onset of phase three of the epidemic in 1995, South Africa has become, I think, a country in a permanent state of private mourning and bereavement. Thank you very much. A moment for those people who've got to leave, and then we can handle any questions. Just in this moment, can I say thank you to the technical team?